Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Good morning and welcome to the morning briefing for Tuesday, November 14th, 2017. I'm your host, Eric Dane. Jake Hughes is your producer on the other side of the glass. And today, well, we've got a very busy show coming up. In just a couple minutes, we'll be joined live in studio by two caregivers, Helen Perry and Jason Corneen, who are in town with the Elizabeth Dole Foundation. Now, Jason's been a guest on the show before with his wife, Alexis, and Helen is currently serving in the Army Reserves as well as serving in her role as caregiver. Then, the founder of Hill Vets, Justin Brown, will be in studio with some of the new class of Hill Vets fellows. They're going to talk about what they're planning to achieve during their time in our nation's capital. And as always, every Tuesday, we'll talk to Justin about what's taking place on Capitol Hill that you and the veteran community need to know about. And later, the executive director of Our Military Kids, Linda Davidson, will join us to talk about her organization, which is set up to support the kids of deployed National Guard and Reserve service members and the children of wounded warriors from all branches. So a very busy show today, as all of our guests will be live in the Connecting Vet Studios, starting with our first two, Helen Perry and Jason Corneen, who we welcome to the show now. Good morning, you two. How are you today, Jason?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Welcome back. And Helen, welcome for the first time to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I think because we've already talked to Jason and we know more than enough about him, let's find out a little bit about Helen. So Helen, tell us just a little bit about your background. I know that you served on active duty, currently in the reserve. So tell us a little bit about your military background as well as your role as caregiver.
Yeah, so I was active duty for 5 years. I was a nurse in the Army Nurse Corps. And I met my husband. He was an infantry Marine, 0311, and he was actually injured in 2008. He had a traumatic brain injury in Afghanistan. And, you know, in 08, we didn't have the studies on brain injuries that we did now. And so, you know, after he got back from deployment, he served and we, you know, we did the things like all dual military couples do. You know, you spend time apart, you get time together, you know, PCS. I think we did like 8 moves in 5 years, right. That kind of thing. And in 2014, he was at a physical therapy appointment. He fell out, had a massive grand mal seizure. His heart stopped. He stopped breathing. 9 seizures later, you know, we were this dual military couple trying to figure out how to get him the help that he needed for these, you know, for this pretty severe brain injury.
Right.
And so I really kind of got thrust into this role of being a caregiver while also being, you know, being active duty. And I was sort of shocked and disappointed and just sort of dismayed at the fact that active duty service members do not qualify for family medical leave in any way, shape, or form. And in fact, the policies that the Department of Defense has for caregivers do not cover active duty service members. You are exempted from every single one of them. So here I was, you know, my husband's in the ICU and, you know, he's like no memory. He lost all his memory. Couldn't, you know, had difficulty speaking, difficulty walking, all this kind of stuff. And I'm like getting text messages from my boss and they're like, yeah, you know, can you come back to work? Because, you know, your emergency leave is up and like, you know, you need to figure this out.
Wow.
And so that kind of put me where I am today. You know, I ended up leaving my career because of it. There was just no way to do both and give him the care that he needed. He ended up medically retiring from the Marine Corps. And so I, you know, chose to transition into the reserves. And so now my whole mission is to start addressing the fact that we are failing our dual military families. You know, we've been working on getting the Department of Defense to recognize that this is a huge issue. There are 98,000 dual military couples in, you know, serving currently. 4.7% of service members are single parents. You know, what happens if your kid gets sick? What happens if your kid has a chronic disease? What happens if your husband gets blown up in Afghanistan? You know, so kind of addressing those issues is what I do on a day-to-day basis.
Right. And that's somewhat similar to what Jason is doing, because Jason, who has been on the show before with his lovely wife, Alexis, in the early days of the morning briefing, one of the more emotional interviews that we've had here on the show. Not the only emotional one, but certainly the first one, I think, up to that point. And Jason's story, of course, is that his wife, Alexis, who he had dated prior to her joining the United States Coast Guard, then suffered a horrible trauma while serving in the Coast Guard. And what happened from there, Jason?
It's been a long journey. Like we've talked about before, she was discharged 18 years ago. So it's been a long journey of trying to navigate the VA from someone who is the opposite of Helen, a military outsider with no medical training. She has the medical training and the military background, and I didn't have either of those. And in the early days, 18 years ago, early days for us, it was a pretty overwhelming and daunting task. So I'm involved with the Elizabeth Dole Foundation just to try to promote more awareness and to help make that process easier for other people getting into the system.
We're speaking with Jason Cornine and Helen Perry, two caregivers. Helen, currently serving in the reserves, also a veteran of the active duty Army, where she served as a nurse. Jason's wife, Alexis, served in the Coast Guard. And one of the aspects that, of course, I remember from speaking to you and Alexis was that she just happened to have been injured prior to September 11th, 2001, which limited the amount of benefits that she was eligible for, which limited the amount of care. Again, had nothing to do with the fact that this was, you know, not a combat zone injury. If this had happened to her on September 12th, 2001, she'd be eligible for a larger amount of benefits. She'd be eligible for everything that everyone post 9/11 is eligible for. She just got hurt at the wrong time, essentially, which is kind of an insane thing to have to say. But have we made any progress on that aspect since we talked to you last on getting some of those pre-9/11 wounded warriors, as it were, the help that they need?
I think we're getting there. I think that's we've got fellows from 50 states all around the country in town this week. We're going to be storming the Hill, seeing our representatives tomorrow. We had a convening yesterday, second annual convening with the VA. And they're engaged in the conversation. They want the legislation to change. They want to be able to support the pre-9/11 population. But we need those legislative changes to happen in order to allow them to do that. So progress is being made. I mean, we're in D.C., right? It's not the fastest progress, but we're certainly making progress. More VSOs and nonprofits are on board with the legislation, and we're moving forward.
Now, Helen, as you've gotten involved with the Elizabeth Dole Foundation, let's talk a little bit about them and what you're doing down here with them. So first off, how did you first come into contact with the Elizabeth Dole Foundation? And then what brought you to D.C. on this trip?
So to be honest, I think I got like a spam email, just to be totally honest. And it was like, sign up for like our caregiver fellows. And I was like, I don't know what this is. So anyways, I ended up looking into it. I had met, you know, because I was a nurse at Walter Reed, so I had always kind of been involved with, like, you know, Semper Fi Fund and all these different organizations that are, like, coming in and helping wounded veterans and all this. Anyways, I saw the fellows class, and I was like, hey, like, let's look into this. Like, maybe this is a good way to make some positive change, right? Because that's what you do, you know, as a service member, right? You identify the problem, you figure out how to fix it, you come up with a solution, and you execute, right? Like, that's the whole point. And so that's kind of what I do with the Elizabeth Dole Foundation now. Like, I identified this problem with, you know, dual military service members and the active duty population being exempted from FMLA. And and so now my plan is, I actually drafted a bill, the Equity and Caregiving for Service Members Act, that we were hoping to have put through last fiscal year, but it got pushed forward. And so now we're going to go start the conversation. And really what we need is to start having this conversation, to start identifying the fact that over the last 10 years, 20,000 enlisted service members from the Army alone have left active duty because of situations that were incompatible due to caregiving. Huh. Whether that be a child, whether that be a family member, a parent, whoever, spouse, whatever, over 20,000. And in fact, the majority of those were the ranks of E4 through E8, the majority being E6. So what a huge hit to our NCO backbone core, right? That we're losing all these people simply because we can't learn to be flexible. Yeah. You're telling me we can put a man on the moon, but we can't figure out how to get an E6 to work from home for 6 months while his kid's in the hospital? Like, come on.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing, you know, having been in the Navy myself, only been on two ships for a total of like 2.5 years out of 13. So not more the seagoing type as so many others were. I was more the overseas type due to my job. But when I was on those ships, when they would get ready to deploy, you would have issues with single parents in particular, some of which seemed to be, what's the word I'm looking for here? Intentional. They didn't want to go out on the ship, so they didn't have any interest in finding proper childcare, figuring, well, the Navy's not going to be able to let me abandon my child, so I'll stay there. But then you had others who were between a rock and a hard place. Didn't have any family to speak of, didn't have any friends that they would trust their child with, because I wasn't a parent then, but being one now, I wouldn't trust anybody with my kid who I didn't have the absolute highest level of trust with. My family and very few friends come up on that list as who I would trust with them. So this is an issue that it's not limited to cases like yours, which are probably among the more rare of that variety, those who are caregivers. It's probably more going to affect the single families.
It happens more than you think. I did a lot of outreach to service members, primarily in the Army, but also other branches, to say, like, hey, like, how often is this happening? And one of the things that I realized is that it's happening a lot more frequently than what we think, because you end up with somebody whose husband has PTSD, or you know, their dad had a stroke, or their kid has cystic fibrosis, or, you know, something like that. And, you know, we do have those, you know, those people who kind of play the system to get out of a hard deployment or a crummy job.
We
whatever.
All know them.
yeah, I mean, it's out there. I'm not going to deny that it's out there. But the problem is that you don't fail the rest of the hardworking people simply because you got the few that are like, you know, the few bad apples.
Yeah.
And so the problem that I had, and what we've kind of heard anecdotally from service members that we've reached out to, is like, so when my husband got injured and I went to my command and I said, hey, I need help, this is where I'm at, their advice to me was, you know, you should probably consider divorce. And I was like, he just got blown up in Afghanistan and you want me to get divorced?
That's something.
Right.
Really, but, Army?
Right.
Really?
but it's not just the Army. That is the attitude in general still that's lingering, is like, if the military wanted you to have a family, they would have issued you one.
Yeah.
And it's the problem, because we're an all-volunteer force. We have more women service members in. We've got all these dual military families. And our policies, to give you an idea, the leave regulation, anybody is welcome to go look this up. If you read the leave regulation, there is a statement in there that says permissive TDY is acceptable for fall harvest.
Hmm.
Fall harvest. When was the last time that we had farms working, like harvesting?
That's actually still in
it
there.
It is. Hand to God, it is.
Oh,
and
my God.
Yet, there is not a policy for my husband getting blown up in Afghanistan.
That's, you know, what do we do for the winter solstice? Is
right,
there anyone
exactly,
who's allowed to
right?
get off of that? For, you know, oh, my God. I can't. That's shocking that, you know, well, if you need to go operate the plow with your family, well, then you can get off. But
the
until
mule horse
then,
died. That's an acceptable
that's,
you know.
But. You know, if your livestock has suffered a case of the dropsies or whatever the hell, that's insane to me. And it's always, you think of it as funny. Like, if you've ever been overseas, and Jason, you probably haven't noticed this, but you may have, AFN commercials that teach you about like some stupid law that's still in the book. Like, if you're driving on the road and a horse comes along, you're required by law to pull your car off the road and dismantle it so as not to scare the horse. That's like a law that's still on the books in Tennessee or someplace like that. I learned that from an AFN commercial, and yes, I worked at AFN, so I was responsible for making some of those. But it's fascinating, and you think of it as funny, but then when you realize there are real world repercussions to people's lives based on these silly, outdated laws, like, what's holding us back from getting it updated? And we're speaking with two caregivers, Jason Corneen and Helen Perry. Helen, her husband is a United States Marine, infantry, 0311, injured in Afghanistan, I believe you said, right? Helmand Province, I'm guessing, because that's where they were. I was up in the north with you crazy Army people.
Yeah, now is that Afghanistan.
Yep. So he was injured over there and later would go on to suffer a seizure, have severe medical issues because of that, and she transitioned from being an active duty nurse in the Army to the reserves. Jason's wife, Alexis, served in the Coast Guard, was injured before 9/11 in a workplace accident, essentially, suffered a traumatic head injury and a traumatic brain injury, and has suffered horribly from that. We've met Alexis before when she came into the studio with Jason a few months back, and they are working to try and raise benefits in Jason and Alexis's case for the pre-9/11 injured, and in Helen's case for active duty family members of those who are injured. So the Elizabeth Dole Foundation, how helpful are they to you guys in getting done what you want to get done? How has that relationship benefited you so far, Jason?
I think it benefits in a few different ways. I think it gives people from all over the country with all different backgrounds the opportunity to have a voice, I think that Helen's perspective, my perspective, the other 50 fellows' perspectives, all bring something to the table. And Senator Dole's gracious enough to help us get in front of the right people to express those concerns. So right. some of these things can be updated. And that's, I think, on the bigger level. On a smaller level, the friendships that you formed. There's a lot of really unlikely friendships that you develop that sense of peer support, that sense of community. For a long time as an individual, as the husband of a Coast Guard vet, there's not a lot of support groups out there for me. Yeah. So, and the caregiving population as it's perceived by the average person might not be perceived as being welcoming to a pre-9/11 husband. That held me back from seeking resources, from seeking support as an individual for a long time. So the fact that the foundation exists and that they would welcome, that they welcome in people of all eras, of all backgrounds, of all genders, and bring them together, and then to see the camaraderie and the friendships that are formed out of that. We come into town once a year for a week to do trainings, to do convenings with the VA, to do policy stuff. But for me, it's the other, you know, 51 weeks a year where I still have those friends and those communities that I can stay in touch with.
And reach out to.
Yeah, and they've established online forums for us to stay in touch beyond just the ones you get to know personally.
And it's interesting that you bring that up, that Alexa served in the Coast Guard, the smallest of the branches by far, which would make, you know, if a case like hers is not rare, even if it's fairly common, it would be much more rare than what you'd find in the other branches. So have you come across anyone who's dealing with the same thing that you are as far as Coast Guard veterans or as far as veterans overall?
Yeah, I mean, I started a support group for Coast Guard husbands. I'm still the only one that shows up. So I sit there in the corner of Starbucks and cry in my coffee by myself. But seriously, I've learned that it doesn't matter. I've learned that I'm probably never going to find someone else in the exact same case that I am.
Right.
But I've also learned, more importantly, that I don't need to. There are people here, people within the foundation, people in the caregiving community that understand. Right. And some of my best friends have come out of that. So I would say that for a long time, I went looking for something that would support me specifically. And then I realized through my involvement with the foundation that it doesn't need to be that specific.
And Helen, you talked about legislation getting involved with the writing of a bill. Has the Dole Foundation been helpful in that aim for you and trying to reach that goal?
Oh, yeah. So I will preface this with, I know nothing. I mean, I literally had to go to
Well, you're in the Army.
Yeah, so, yeah, we know. Already. I had to Schoolhouse Rock, just watch I literally watched that to be like, what's the process? Like Google, how to write a bill, you know?
You watched a cartoon from the 1970s.
That's right. It was very educational. Turns out the process hasn't changed much, but you know, they've been great in terms of mentoring, and you know, Senator Dole is a wealth of knowledge and experience.
Right.
You know, she's like the classic, you know, pearls dress, you know, she's way classier than I am. But she's been like so helpful and such a great mentor, because you know, she'll provide you with feedback. That was one of the best things that I had, was that they kind of went through and said, well, this language is very vague, you need to be more specific, yada yada.
Right.
So it was really, really great to have that kind of guidance and senior leadership to kind of set the example, to say like, hey, this is how to get this done, and this is where you start, and this is how it goes forward. And so it's, you know, the first attempt wasn't successful. We're hoping subsequent attempts will be successful. We can start this conversation with the Department of Defense and with, you know, Congress and with the Senate, and kind of get them to recognize that like our military families are deserving of having the same benefits that everybody else is currently getting and has been getting since 1993.
Yeah. The fact that just because you were a spouse who also happened to be on active duty, you weren't eligible for the same things that, let's say if I were married to someone who were injured, in the line of duty, and then I was a civilian, I'd be eligible for more than you. I'd be eligible for benefits that you're not. That would seem to be counterintuitive. It would seem that the active duty spouse should be eligible for even more.
You would think so, because two military members in a family, like that's a double investment to the Department of Defense. Like I look at this from a pure numbers standpoint, right? Because that's the only way to get the DOD to do anything is to like preach to them the money numbers, you know? And if you look at this, like, you know, the numbers I talked about, over 20,000 service members in the last 10 years who've left service because of caregiving, think about what that represents financially. Basic training. So, you know, advanced training, AIT, BLC, you know, all these different courses that they go to. And then they're leaving service to go to the civilian sector because the civilian sector is more flexible. If, you know, if you look at what I did as a nurse, you know, just to, you know, these name acronyms won't mean anything to you, but to medical people it will. I am, ACLS, BLS, PALS, TNCC, ITLS, PHTLS, TC3, C4. I am trained in every computer system that the military has for medical. I am a trauma instructor for the Department of Defense. I represent a significant investment by the Department of Defense. And I left my job because we couldn't find flexibility for the short-term time that my husband was in and out of the hospital. How tragic is that, right? Like, I was a committed, you know, service member. My OERs are top-notch. You know, I did all the things. I can pass my PT test, yada, 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 whatever. But the fact of the matter is I left because we couldn't be flexible. And so, you know, it's to me, it's antiquated policy. We just need to update it. The Department of Defense is unfortunately not very good about keeping up to date with some things.
Right.
And so I think it's really just a conversation that we need to have, to sit down and have, you know. If the Secretary of Defense is listening, hint, hint, James.
Hey, Jim, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing? you know, just saying, like, let's start the conversation. Let's start taking care of our military families. If you invest in your soldiers, they will invest into their service and they will stay. We will have a more capable military. We will have happy military families. I would venture to say things like, you know, depression and suicide ideation, things like that would go down if you start giving them the support that they need at home.
Those were a lot of acronyms. I have been to TGIF before. They have very good potato skins. I enjoyed TGIF. Also TCBY, the country's best yogurt. I don't think they're around anymore, but they were good at the time. So we're coming to the last few minutes here. And one thing that I want to talk to both of you about, because you come at this from different perspectives. Jason, you never served. Your wife did, actually, before you were married. And, of course, Helen, you served while your husband was injured and then afterwards and then switched over to the reserves because of the problems that you came upon. But when you think back to, Jason, at the beginning of your marriage, when you started becoming the caregiver for Alexis, Helen, after your husband was injured, what are some things you wish you'd known about helping your significant other that you're the caregiver for that you've learned over the past years as you've been doing this?
I'll take that one first.
Yeah.
I think for me that resources are available. If you look at the state of the VA and the state of the nonprofit world 18 years ago compared to now, it's changed dramatically. So I would think that to go looking for resources, to know that there are people out there that want to help, and unfortunately they can't help unless you ask for it. So for me, the first 10 years, if I'm being honest, I was probably detrimental to her care in my stubbornness, my unwillingness to say, I can't handle this all by myself. And I need some help, and to go find those resources and bring those people in. And I'll also say that those resources are out there. They are more prevalent. We have a super simple website, hiddenheroes.org, that you can go to search for any sort of help you need, whether it's counseling, financial help, more urgent needs, whatever you need. The resources are out there. So I would say that would be my advice to anybody in the beginning would be, you're not alone. You don't have to do it by yourself. And the resources are out there.
And Helen?
Yeah, I would say I would totally second that. I was really resistant to ask for help. I still am. I don't like admitting that, like, I can't handle this all on my own. And I would say get organized, make a plan, research your benefits, know what benefits you qualify for. It's a fight. It's a fight every day, especially with the VA, to make sure that you're getting, that your spouse is getting the benefits that they deserve. You know, that my own VA claim took like over a year. I was one of the backlog people. You know, I went through a whole disaster with that. But yeah, know your benefits, know what you qualify for. And if you don't know, ask. Yeah. If they don't know, Google. You know, like, there's a whole world of resources out there. But don't be afraid to reach out for support. Like, probably one of the best things that I've gotten from the Elizabeth Dole Foundation is the camaraderie of other people who are in the exact same, you know, the number of times I've been like, oh my God, you're in this too. Like, you're in the exact same spot. Like, oh my God, you know, because you think you're alone and you're not. And, so just knowing that there's a whole community of people out there who are going through the exact same thing, who can, if anything, just be a shoulder to cry on, you know, somebody to talk to rebound ideas off of. You know, reach out for those resources.
And, you know, if somebody thinks something doesn't sound right, check, you know, find out from some of these. Because just because someone at the VA told you that, no, we don't do that, they've been known to be wrong. I don't know if you've paid attention to the news over the last few years, but occasionally the people at the VA are incorrect about things, particularly when it comes to the bureaucracy. That's where we see most of the issues. The care at the VA, not as many issues as far, it's getting to the point of the care, getting the paperwork done, getting accepted, getting all that stuff. So we've been speaking with Jason Cornine and Helen Perry. They are both caregivers. Helen served in the United States Army on active duty as a nurse, currently serving in the reserves. Jason, he didn't serve. He came to his wife after she was done serving, after her traumatic brain injury, but that doesn't make him any less important to one of our great veterans, Mrs. Alexis Cornine, I should say. So if people want to find out more about the Elizabeth Dole Foundation, where do they go to do that, Jason, Helen, whoever?
So you can go online. We have a Facebook presence. You can go on the website, hiddenheroes.org. And just Google Elizabeth Dole Foundation. There's plenty of stuff out there.
A lot of great stuff that the Dole Foundation is doing, and you can find out about it online. Our thanks to Jason Cornine and Helen Perry. Coming up in just a few minutes, Justin Brown, founder and CEO of Hillvets, and a couple of his new fellows. Stick around after this.
Helping military veterans stay connected.
We make it easy.
We're CBS Radio's ConnectingVets.com. Connecting Vets every day.
Online and all over social media. Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter at Connecting Vets.
Welcome back to the Morning Briefing here on CBS Radio's ConnectingVets.com. I'm your host, Eric Dame. Jake Hughes is your producer. On the other side of the glass, actually just stepped outside on the other side of the door to be specific and accurate. And already a good show today, and it's going to just keep on getting more gooder from here. That's right, because me speak good English. Me do so at CBS Radio's ConnectingVets.com. Connecting Vets every day. That is the website created for veterans by veterans. And we mean that. Each and every member of our team is either a veteran ourselves or very closely related to the military community. How closely related? Well, we have the spouses of veterans, the children's of veterans on our team, and of course, the veterans themselves. Like Jake did 13 years in the Army, I did 13 in the Navy, and everybody else on our team also has their own story and their own ties to the military, which is why we think we have the unique perspective required to give you the news, information, entertainment, and so forth that you need. Things that are going to make your life better. Like, for example, I did a story yesterday on the website, also on social media, where we are at Connecting Vets. Did you know that as of November 11th, if you are a veteran who was honorably discharged, you are now eligible to shop online at all four of the military exchanges? That includes AFES, that includes the NEX, that includes the Marine Corps Exchange, the Coast Guard Exchange, all of them. All you got to do is go and register. And actually, if you go check out my story on ConnectingVets.com or on our Facebook page, where we are at Connecting Vets, it has a link right to the site where you verify your veteran status. Then you're able to go on there. A buddy of mine, he's a horrible human being. He served in the Air Force, though, so we got to give him a little bit of credit for that. Apparently found a crock pot that he was looking for. He found it on Amazon for like $70. Already, first thing he looked up on the new exchange privilege that he has, found it for like $40 or $50 or something like that. So saving money already. Not just that, but also the latest and greatest taking place around the veteran community. You'll find out all about it. And the best way to be kept abreast is to follow us on social media. We are at Connecting Vets on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. A little tap of the phone or click of your mouse will change your life for the better. Especially if you listen to this show every day, because we have fantastic guests coming on Monday through Friday. And every Tuesday around this time, we welcome Justin Brown to the studio. And today is no different. But it is a little bit different in that Justin has brought some guests along with him. So Justin, founder and CEO of Hillvets, of course, friend of the show. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Hey, and, Eric, how are you?
You have brought two special guests with you this morning, and we're going to ask them, since they have to share a microphone, to speak nice and loudly and get nice and close to that microphone when they talk. Can you introduce your two Hillvets fellows that you've brought with you today?
Yeah, you betcha. I've got Thomas Himes here with me and Elizabeth Fitzgerald, two fine veterans who have come all the way to Washington, D.C. to be a part of our Hillvets House program, which is essentially we're bringing the best and brightest veterans from across the country, flying them in, housing them here in Washington, D.C., and placing them on Capitol Hill.
And let's find out just a little bit about them. So, Elizabeth, as he mentioned, you are a veteran yourself. Tell us just a little bit about your service, where you're from, when you served, and what you did while you were in.
I am former Air Force.
Oh, boy.
And I worked with the Air Force for 6.5 years as a JAG. I was stationed at Bowling Air Force Base, Whiteman Air Force Base.
Did you prosecute any of my trials? I was just out of curiosity. No.
Probably not in Navy. No. Sorry. And also at Air Education and Training Command in San Antonio, Texas.
Ah, very cool. And how about yourself? Air Force as well, or what are we looking at here?
No, I served in the U.S. Navy for 4 years.
There you go. I knew he was a good guy. I could tell when he came in here. I wasn't sure about anybody else in this room.
Does have that look about him, Justin. Doesn't
he? Yeah, he's got that Navy look. So you were in for how long?
4 years.
4 years. And what'd you do while you were in?
I was an engineman aboard the USS McFall.
Oh, wow. So very cool. So some sea time under your belt, I would imagine, getting out on the high seas, as they call them.
A few days.
Yeah, I literally have only a few days. Out of 13 years in the Navy, I think I did like 3 years on a ship, 2.5 years on a ship. So not much time. And a lot of it was spent in dry dock and things like that. So, you know, what made you want to get involved with the Hill Vets Fellowship? If we can find out just a little bit about why you wanted to get involved with the program that Hill Vets offers.
I wanted to get involved with Hill Vets to kind of continue my service and work on the Hill. I was in Austin, Texas, working at a state agency, and just really wanted to try and get involved in something at the national level in D.C.
Right. And for our sailor, what made you want to go from, you know, going around like a pirate does on the high seas to coming in to deal with the pirates on Capitol Hill?
No, I wanted to continue trying to help change society for the better and make a difference. And I think that being on the Hill is one way to do that.
And so far during your time here, Elizabeth, what has been the how long have you been here, first off, with the Hill Vets Fellowship, I should ask?
I've been here about 2.5 weeks now.
So you've had some time to see how everything works. And what's been your impression of how everything works on Capitol Hill and the works that Hill Vets doing?
It's been a steep learning curve, which I think most veterans are used to. If you've been in the military, yeah. You have a pretty steep learning curve. I find it pretty fascinating. I'm glad I'm a part of it.
And it is really something fascinating to me as well, not being involved in politics at all and then coming down and finding out about all the things that Hill Vets and other organizations are doing to make sure veterans have their voices heard on Capitol Hill. That is extremely important. How do you feel you'll be able to contribute to getting the veteran message out there on Capitol Hill to the politicians on the local or national level, really?
Well, I've been pretty lucky in the office I'm working in to have a couple of months with the defense fellow. Mm. So kind of teaching me the ropes. And I think that's going to help with my steep learning curve to be able to advocate for veterans issues fairly early in my time on the Hill. Also, I think veterans, especially with veterans issues, I think their voice has a really heavy weight in the room on that issue.
There are certainly a lot of issues that are affecting the veteran community as it takes place right now. A lot of legislation on Capitol Hill that has a direct effect on us, whether it comes to medical care, whether it comes to benefits, education. We just saw changes to the GI Bill come through. What have been some of the biggest things that you've noticed during your time paying attention to legislation? And then here in these 2.5 weeks that you've been in D.C. working with Hill Vets, what's caught your eye is what you think is the most important thing veterans are facing legislatively?
Well, I think obviously the choice program, which, you know, people would say is being expanded in an effort to privatize healthcare through a back door.
Yeah, and that is an issue and one that a lot of the VSOs are looking at and saying, hey, you know, we don't want this to happen. But I think the more veterans' voices that we have up there, whether they're for that or against it, the privatization of the VA, just having those opinions out there and hearing the different sides of that argument, I think is important. And that's something that, of course, the fellows working with the Hill Vets program will be able to take part in during their time on Capitol Hill as they work as fellows with Justin Brown and the rest of the team over at Hill Vets. So what's the one thing as you know, work your way through this fellowship that you're hoping to really take from it? Is there anything that you're hoping you're able to achieve or to add to your tool bag when you're done with your fellowship?
I think my big takeaway from working on the Hill is going to be the ability to look strategically at veterans' issues. I've been affected by the VA since I got out of the Air Force, and but it's been my my small view. So to be able to look at healthcare for veterans across the nation, it would be my takeaway from that.
Right. And how about for you?
To be able to look at politicians as human beings.
Yeah. Well, that is a big thing. And as you mentioned as well, having your own personal perspective, having an opinion is one thing. I have opinions. That's why I do this. I have opinions and I get to talk about them all day long. However, an opinion does not make a good strategy. You know, having something that you think, well, okay, that may be the end goal that you want to get to how things should be. But looking at politics and the way that things work and realizing that you're not just dealing with these statues, these are actual people, as you mentioned here on Capitol Hill, there has to be a strategy and there has to be a correct way that you go about doing things to get your message out there. And I think it's great that you guys are working along with Hill Vets, because I don't know anybody in Washington, D.C. who's better at planning those strategies and talking about them and getting the message across than Mr. Justin Brown of Hill Vets. And we're going to bring him into the conversation now because we have those talking points that we need to talk about every week with you, because, well, there's a lot going on, as I mentioned, on Capitol Hill that affects the veteran community. In fact, there was supposed to be a House Veterans Affairs Committee on Wednesday that was going to be, well, it was going to be one thing, but didn't turn out that way, did it, Justin?
That's right, Eric. As Thomas from our team here insinuated and brought up the discussion of this broader choice reform, which everybody's really, really keeping their eyes on, there were some surprises. And frankly, the House Veterans Affairs Committee decided to pull their proposed choice legislation from being marked up. And what that means is in the process of passing a bill is that it moves from the committee to the full House of Representatives for consideration of a vote. And ultimately, that's how you pass a bill.
Yeah.
So what happened is they pulled the bill from consideration to be marked up. And the reason they cited was a CBO score. And what that is, you know, when folks sit down and they say, this is how much it's going to cost our government. So what they did is they said that they're going to wait for that score to come back before they consider the bill any further. Now, preceding this decision was what I would say some interesting things going on in terms of there was some late language that was added. Some folks insinuated that language was being pushed from concerned veterans of America who have very openly been looking to privatize VA healthcare and really push this notion of choice to veterans, basically. If you want VA, you can use VA. If you don't want VA, you don't have to use VA. some of the challenges as you also brought up, many of the VSOs oppose that notion, they certainly opposed this additional language in the lead up to the bill being pulled. So where we stand now is that the committee has said that they are waiting for a CBO score to come back. I can't fathom any way that bill is not extraordinarily expensive. Yeah. So what that's going to do is that's going to certainly push some big dilemmas, I think, to lawmakers in terms of how they're going to move this bill forward. Once they do have a score, where are they going to find those offsets? If they find them, that means that they're going to have to cut something else or not, which would be meaning that they're essentially deficit spending, right? So they're adding to the deficit. So Congress has some tough decisions with regards to how this moves forward. If they can't find that funding, their easiest solution is a temporary fix. And we've seen those time and time again. And that's where Congress comes back and says, hey, you know, let's add, you know, $4 billion, $10 billion, whatever it may be. Right. The initial choice was something to the effect of $20 billion. And it just kind of moves the ball down the road, but it's not necessarily substantive reform, which we've been seeing, or we've seen it being requested, you know, not, you know, by the president, throughout the Trump administration, through, you know, the House, through the Senate. Everybody's been calling for broad VA reform. And, you know, obviously the American people are looking for some folks to deliver on that promise.
Yeah. And the choice program is it's an interesting one because I have yet to hear anyone say that they don't see a benefit in choice. It's just a worry of getting too focused on the outside care, where it's almost like somebody the other day was using the analogy of ice cream flavors. Like, all right, vanilla is fantastic, but chocolate might be better in some situations. But then if you get rid of the vanilla and only have the chocolate, then you might start missing the vanilla. Not the best analogy, but I thought it was a pretty good one because I like ice cream. Choice is one where we just had the Keith Harmon, National Commander in Chief of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, in here and saying, listen, the choice program is important. A lot of our veterans, a lot of our VFW members are they want choice to stay. They want it to stick around. I think the issue is, again, pushing too far in one direction to the detriment of the other side of the house, that being the VA care, where we've talked about this before. Most of the issues I hear about the VA from the veterans we have on the show are not about the care that they receive, but the bureaucracy, getting to the appointment, getting an appointment set up, paperwork issues. I had my dental records lost by the VA. I don't know how, but they were lost. You know, things like that. So yeah, choice is one that.
And I think you're right. And I think we're going to see some of that play out, right? I think the major VSOs like AMVETS, like the VFW, like the DAV, what they're looking for is the best possible health care to the highest number of veterans at the lowest possible cost. And the challenge is getting there. And I don't think that any of those major veteran service organizations, and in fact, I believe CBO will come back and confirm this, believe that pushing to extreme privatization is going to reduce costs. And the problem with that is that if it's not reducing costs, and we're going to see that in this bill, you know, does Congress really want to pay for, frankly, what's somewhat ideological? Yeah. So that's the choice that they're going to have to make if CBO doesn't come back and say, you know, and maybe I'm wrong, and we'll see when they come back with the score. I'm doubting it. Yeah. But you know, when CBO comes back with the score and shows, you know, how much this extra private care is going to cost, that's gonna make it really tough for a Republican Congress to say, okay, we're going to go down this road. We're going to continue to provide the same amount of care to our American veterans, and at an extraordinary cost because we want it to be privatized versus VA. And I think the VSOs realize the writing is on the wall in terms of, hey, you know, where VA works, where we can invest in VA and make it work, we want that to happen. And I think poll after poll that you'll see from you know, VA and others is that once veterans receive VA care, they really like that care. So it's an access to care issue.
There, of course, are exceptions to that. And there are even full VA medical centers that are just need a lot of work. We know that. Yeah. But we can also find the great ones out there that are doing wonderful things. So, you know, there's a bit of a, I think we need to find a bit of a middle ground where we increase the care that's being offered at some of the underperforming medical centers. That will allay some of the fears that people have. Although some of it that comes out of the Phoenix VA debacle and some of the other things that have happened around the country. Do you think some of that's just so firmly set in some veterans' minds that they're never going to trust the VA again? Because I personally think there are some people that are never going to trust the VA because of what they've seen over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certainly individual experiences which are horrific to the point, you know, where a veteran can get so frustrated that they decide, I'm no longer interested in participating in VA healthcare. And I understand that. I'm a veteran from Salt Lake City, and you know, I believe in VA healthcare. And when I received, and some of that may be because I started at Salt Lake City. And Salt Lake City, for the most part, for me, was a place where I couldn't walk down the hall and somebody wouldn't ask me if I'm heading in the right direction. Just, you know, phenomenal people. All my doctors were great. And that's my personal experience. But my personal experience also includes the Washington, D.C. VA Medical Center, which
not had the best track record lately.
That's right. It you know, and it's never had a good track record with me for the most part. I can tell you when I get to my primary physician, he does a great job. But it's everything in between, whether it's the parking, whether it's the experience at, you know, the security gate, because I'm you know, going to the CBOC at Fort Belvoir, whether it's the person at the front desk that's telling me, you know, I've got the flu, but they're trying to send me to the DCVA Medical Center, which is over an hour away. All those things add up to really, really bad healthcare experiences.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they happen in the private sector as well. And you know, if you receive that type of treatment from a certain private sector physician, you would probably leave that.
You'd probably never go back.
Right. You know? And so, I mean, I think that's some of the fundamental argument that's being tossed around here in terms of, you know, choice. But, you know, there is also this bigger philosophical picture, which is, you know, how do we get the most healthcare to the most veterans at the highest quality at the lowest cost?
Different people have different ideas about that. Of course, there are groups like Concerned Veterans, who you mentioned, partisan conservative group, support from the Koch brothers behind them, Vote Vets, partisan liberal group, I guess you would call them. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so.
That have basically said that they're going to
out of Seattle or something. Yeah, must be liberal.
Up there where it's always raining, everybody's wearing Birkenstocks all day long. We know what's happening up there in the Pacific Northwest. Us Northeasterners don't trust them, and neither apparently do the good folks of Salt Lake City, as Justin Brown is. He is the founder and CEO of
Hillvets. They endorsed me once upon a time. I should be nice.
There you go. Well, not me, so I don't care. I don't have to be nice to them.
An election a long time ago. You can read about it. It's called How to Lose an Election in Less Than 90 Days.
Wow. That's... I will have to check that out. Now, the VA and DOD also hosted a day-long interoperability roundtable last week with speakers and panelists from a bunch of different departments in DOD, essentially, and the VA. What was that all about, and how did it go?
Yeah, so I wasn't actually at the panel, so I don't know for sure how it went. But what is interesting about it is, you know, you have a number of very, very big companies coming together, Epic, Cerner, even Google, joining in on this conversation. And I think there's this idea at VA that they're looking for complete interoperability. And I think what that means to all the big names in the room for electronic healthcare record companies is that big government on a very, really on two very big contracts, one being Cerner going to DOD, one being Cerner going to VA. And then obviously, you know, Cerner at VA and Cerner at DOD should be able to talk to each other. But the bigger nut to crack is how do we make Cerner, Epic, Google, and all these other EHRs speak to one another? And if we can do that, what that does allow for VA to do, you know, as they move down this road of, you know, increased choice. I mean, that's certainly the priority of this administration, you know, providing more choice, providing more private healthcare, is that anybody that any of those doctors in the local community that are using those platforms ought to be able to work with the VA. And that's one of the big challenges with VA healthcare in the private sector right now, even with current choices that exist, is that we'll send these veterans to these doctors, but they don't have access to VISTA, which is the current VA electronic healthcare record. And we lose continuity of care.
Right. And so, also want to point out that Google, with all the people they have and all the money they spend, should be able to come up with a better name for something than Google Medical Brain. Come on, guys. That's not even doing it half speed. All right. We've only got a couple of minutes left, but a couple things left to talk about. One is, of course, the HHS, Health and Human Services Secretary position, was open for quite a while. Secretary Shulkin from the VA was rumored to be one of the considered folk to take over that position. Then that was shot down and said, no,
he was pushed back really quick, wasn't it?
No. Eventually. But they have announced a new HHS secretary.
They sure have. They have. Alex Azar, who had previously served at HHS, in a role of general counsel from 2001 to 2005, and then served as deputy secretary from 06 to 07, both in George Bush's administration, has been announced as the candidate to fill that position. Obviously, pending his confirmation, it would appear Secretary Shulkin is officially out of the running.
Yeah, well, I would hope so if they named the guy, and then that would be just brutal. If they
People were concerned, and I think rightfully so.
I remember Joe Schinelli from AmVets penned like an op-ed, and it was
fired
you
up.
Can't leave, man. You don't want to get that Marine angry at you. I've known him for 20 years. You really don't want to get him angry.
But, you know, I mean, it was VA was one of the last slots filled for the secretary position, at least in the big cabinet-level agencies, and it was a big to-do, and you know, who's going to come in and backfill for Secretary Shulkin? And it was, I think, a contentious issue for the VSOs, and the administration knew it, and I think they probably made the right decision.
Yeah, it seemed that there was a lot of worry going around over those week or two that Shulkin was thought to be considered for that post. But, of course, it didn't happen. And finally, VA officials launching a new advisory board to review department benefits. Why are they doing this? If we can talk about it very briefly, we've got about a minute and a half.
Yeah. So I think this, frankly, stems back to AmVet's effort to kill an effort that was going to raise a lot of funding in the budget under an item called individual unemployability, if you remember that.
Yeah.
And at the time, I think there were a number of conversations I had with Secretary Shulkin, which were, look, if you're going to try to change existing benefits, you're going to have a very, very difficult time doing that. Yeah. What you need to do is kind of look point forward. You know, if you were going to change benefits, how do we take them from point forward and bring the brightest minds in the room and say, you know, is the benefit system doing what we expect it to do for veterans? Me personally, I don't. But there's certainly a number of ways I think that VA can look to reforming that process, bringing it into the 20th century, and hopefully this moves the agenda forward in a positive way. But hopefully it also serves veterans in the ways that they need to be served.
Serving veterans in the way that they need to be served is Hill Vets, a wonderful organization headed up by founder and CEO Justin Brown. Thank you to him and Elizabeth and Thomas, Air Force and Navy veterans, respectively, who joined us here on the Morning Briefing today. They are Hill Vets Fellows. And, of course, if people want to learn more about Hill Vets, Justin, where do they go to do so?
Find us at hillvets.org or on Twitter at Hill Vets.
That's where you want to go. But right now, you want to stay right here. Our Military Children CEO, Executive Director, coming up next.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL Draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.